And welcome to the next episode of the Oxfordshire Light Blues podcast. My name is Matthew Sandage and I'm the Secretary of Oxfordshire Light Blues. I'm joined here today by Andy Proper. Andy, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, yeah, thanks, Matt. I'm Andy. I'm from Carfax Lodge 5723, currently the Senior Warden, and I'm here to obviously help with this podcast.
Cool. Thanks, Andy. And in the hot seat today, we've got Chris Wagstaff. And Chris is working on a new lodge in Oxfordshire, the Sir William Morris Lodge, which we're going to find out quite a bit more about later. Chris, do you want to just introduce yourself briefly?
Hello, Matthew and Andrew. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me today. I'm not sure you'll be so pleased to hear after me afterwards, but it's great. It's a privilege to be asked, and hopefully your listeners will find things of interest.
So I guess to get started, Chris, could you just give us a bit of a background to your journey in Freemasonry, and how did you get involved and when?
I suppose I got involved with Freemasonry because I got drunk. I went to an old school reunion up at the Public Schools Club in London and in St. James's Square. And it was a school organised thing. It was a fundraising thing. And of course, as most fundraising things, I think they're after a new gym, they ply you with plenty of alcohol to loosen your wallet. They wouldn't loosen mine, of course, but... Anyway, I bumped into an old school friend, and he had a Masonic tie pin on. And so I said, oh, I know what that is. And we got talking about it. And he said, how do I know about it? And I said, well, I explained that there's a deep vein of Freemasonry in my family. My father's a Freemason. My grandfather was, my uncles, my brother-in-law. Even my brother's a Freemason. And then my great-uncles, there's a lot of history. And so he explained that his type in came from the old Blocksmith's Lodge, which of course was the old school lodge, and I had absolutely no idea it existed. I was not a great fan of Freemasonry. I had no intention whatsoever of joining. My grandfather used to come up to me and say, hey lad, when are you going to join the craft? And of course he batted that one away. But that evening I suddenly thought, well, do you know what? If you can't beat them, might as well join them. And I didn't want to join my family lodge, which is in Buckinghamshire. And I thought, well, why not join the old Blocksmith's Lodge? So I was duly interviewed in a pub in London, where else? And on the 14th of October, 1995, I was initiated into the old Blocksmith's Lodge, number 7725, in the province of Oxfordshire. And the date is quite an apt date, because my father also was initiated on the 14th of October, but 1959. So I was 95, he was 59, 9 and 5 reversed are the same. So there's a little bit of a tie.
Lovely. Thanks for giving us that very brief insight.
The brief.
No, it was very brief. But obviously, we're here to talk about the Sir William Morris Lodge. The number escapes me. Sorry. Is there a number?
There is. If we've gone past the 999 barrier. It's number 10003 or 10003.
Wow. Okay. Very, very close. I think the 10,000 was left for somebody else, wasn't it? I suppose.
I think it was a Metropolitan Lodge. 9999 went to an emergency services lodge, quite aptly. There's a Sussex Classic Car Lodge is 10,004, and I think there's a Motorcycle Lodge which is 10,005. So
oh, good. Okay. We've got a bit of background on that. Fantastic. So moving into the obviously talking about the Sir William Morris Lodge, where did the idea come about for the lodge?
Well, I've always been a petrol head, but that can't really be the reason why the lodge was founded. The province was looking at ways of bringing new vitality into lodges and to expand. So earlier on last year, we had the Ruck and Mall Lodge, which was the Rugby Lodge, which was founded. And a list had gone out in the province of what things the brethren would be interested in forming. So we had an exotic fine dining lodge was put forward, a beer lodge, that was very popular, but has yet to be formed. There was a fishing lodge, I think a camping lodge, and of course the car lodge. So that was probably the most popular, actually, or the most popular vote. And so I'm an assistant PMO, which stands for Provincial Membership Officer, helping Dave Robinson out. And so he actually was the first master of the rugby lodge. And so because I sort of got my weight behind it, considerable weight, that is, behind the motor lodge, I guess I sort of at the first committee meeting put myself forward to be the primus master. So and I was all approved, so I'm the primus master designate. But the story behind why it's called Sir William Morris is quite an interesting one, and I've been in quite a lot of research on it recently. But my parents lived in Nuffield, and of course Sir William Morris was Lord Nuffield, and he lived opposite in a place called Nuffield Place, and in fact used to own my parents' farm at one point. So there's I knew all about him, but I'd picked up through the grapevine a snippet of information that Lord Nuffield, or Sir William Morris, was a Freemason and had been a member of Alfred Lodge, number 340, which of course is Oxfordshire's oldest lodge. So I did a bit of digging about with the help of Philip Purvis, and I got some scant information, but it was enough to go on, that Sir William Richard Morris had been initiated, sorry, hadn't been initiated, he was a joining member of Alfred Lodge in 1907 and remained a member of that lodge until his death in 1963. He was also a hugely philanthropic bloke, it's easy for you to say, and it's unknown exactly how much he gave, but estimates range between 1.5 and 2 billion pounds in today's money in charitable causes. And of course you have Nuffield University, which he paid for, the Nuffield Health Organization, which started off as a trust. He put huge amounts of money into I think it was the Naval Reserves or the Scouts or whatever it's called. So he didn't have children of his own, but just gave most of his wealth away. And so I thought, well, you know, he's obviously also involved in the motor industry, and if we're going to set up a motor lodge, why not pick one of our own, an Oxfordshire Freemason who did an enormous amount for charity, and of course was at one point ran the company which was the largest motor manufacturer in the UK. So a good choice, I thought. So anyway, going on from that, we sent out messages to via the Second Rising and out towards secretaries, asking if there's anyone interested in becoming a founder member of the lodge. And sure enough, it was quite popular, and we've got over 30 founders. Unfortunately, a couple have had to drop out, so we've got 30 founders now. There were a few more interested, but because of the rules, which I'm sure you're going to ask me on about, you know, the restrictions on what, and the regulations on forming a new lodge, they prevented us from having a few more.
I was going to say that segues quite nicely into our next topic area, which is, could you just describe how that process worked? I mean, how did you actually have to go about setting up a new lodge? What do you have to do? What are the rules and regulations?
Okay, so there's a lot of strange rules and regulations, which I won't go into, but in principle, you need 7 founders. I think it's 7, or is it 11? No, I think it's 7. which of course is a magic number in Freemasonry, which doesn't sound like an awful lot. And I wouldn't recommend anybody founded a lodge with seven founders, principally because it does get a little bit expensive to found a lodge, because if you think about the things you take for granted in your lodges, you know, in Carfax and Blockley, you've got all the regalia, you've probably got your own Bible, and you've got the warrant of your lodge, and you know, all the little trappings that you have actually cost an awful lot of money. For example, you know, even if you're going to buy a Bible new, you're looking at nearly 600 quid. So if you've only got seven founders, you know, that's nearly 100 quid a piece. The warrant is about £500. It's just under. And of course, once you've got the warrant, you've got to, you know, frame it, look after it. So there's all that expense. There are costs for petitioning, I believe. I've forgotten that now. But in essence, once you've got your founders, and I'd recommend as many as you can get, you then have to fill in a form with each founder, and they have to sign it. And that's a bit of a palaver, because, of course, if you've got people from all over the country, you've got to zip here, there and everywhere, desperately trying to get your signatures. But along with that, you need clearance certificates from every single lodge that founder has been a member of. And of course, you know, some elder people have been members of lodges that have long since gone. So you've got to try and dig up records and this, that, and the other of lodges that have, you know, you have to get clearance from Grand Lodge, and it just takes such a long time. So it's not something that you want to take on lightly. And once you've got all the form together, that has to be sent off to the Grand Secretary. Sorry, not Grand Secretary. I'm giving him elevation. The Provincial Grand Secretary, who then goes through it with the fine tooth comb and picks out all the faults and the mistakes that we've made and throws it back. And then once that's all been done, it's signed off by the Provincial Grand Master and then sent up to Grand Lodge, who then go through it with a fine tooth comb again. But if they reject it, it takes an awful lot longer than the Provincial Grand Secretary chucking it back. So that's why he does such a good job in that. Not looking for promotion or anything, you know, but once that's been approved, it goes before the Board of General Purposes at Grand Lodge, and that's before a quarterly communication, and they will then approve it or throw it back and what have you, and they give it a number. And so from that point, once that form is submitted, there's you can't have any more founders, you know, that's the line drawn, which is a real shame, actually, because we got hit by COVID, obviously, and so our warrant was delayed anyway, but we had hoped to have had our consecration by now, and of course no chance of that. So it's meant that delaying a year, we've had a lot of approaches from people that say, oh, can we be a founder? Can we be a founder? And of course they can't, which is a real shame. We could have probably had another 10 more.
Talking about your consecration, have you got a date set for that yet?
Certainly have. It's going to be an absolute belter of a day. And if you haven't signed up, I suggest you do now. It's on the 8th of May. I say it's the 8th of May. That's COVID permitting, you know, who knows when this dreadful thing's going to pass, but so 8th of May 2021, and it's going to be at the Oxford Transport Museum, which is in, get this right because you get it wrong, Longhambra, which is sort of near Whitney and Woodstock, so just outside Oxford. Great location because it's right beside the train station, and it's like 15 minutes on the train from Oxford, or even less, you know, like 35 minutes from Reading. So it's really, really good communications. And there's a whole lot of parking as well. So in terms of location, it's perfect. slightly unusual because it is a bus museum for first and foremost, but also has a whole wing which is dedicated to Sir William Morris, and there are like 14 or 15 Morris cars in there, and is on two stories, and there's all the information on the factories and pictures and cutaway engines and you name it. You could spend, if you're a bit of a petrol head, just in the William Morris area alone, you could probably spend about a day and a half. Of course, then they've got all the buses. And there are some really interesting buses, including Morris buses, I have to say. So they've got some fabulous buses. They've got like the Morris band bus, which is it's like a Decca and a half. It's all raised at the back where all the band equipment went in. So it's Morris Motors brass band. And they, you know, they were quite successful apparently in the 50s and 60s, you know, trucking around the country, playing their musical instruments. So it's interesting to see that too. And what they're going to be doing for us is to empty out one of the halls where they move a couple of their buses out, and we are going to have the consecration ceremony in amongst the exhibits.
That sounds brilliant.
Well, I think it's going to be very unique because hopefully the dignitaries will be seated in a 1904 or 1907 charabang, just to the right of the worshipful master. The overflow seating will be in a 1950s or 60s route master bus. It's in the corner of the hall, and we're going to, even though it has great visibility from the top, those on the other side, on the far side of the bus won't have huge, great visibility. So we're going to put video screens in there and live stream it to the bus.
Sounds fun.
Stuff.
Sounds fun.
It's definitely something I'm looking forward to. And what can people expect from the Sir William Morris Lodge? I mean, how many times are you meeting? Where are you meeting? What are your meetings going to be like?
Yeah, so certainly for the first year, there's going to be slightly unusual because I'm going to be worshipful master. At the consecration, a lot of the members will be bringing their cars, and also so are visitors. So we're probably going to have about 40 or 50 cars, I should think. So it'll be like a car show. And there'll be some very exciting beasts turning up, I can assure you that. I'm not going to give too much away about some of our tricks that we've got up our sleeve, but it's going to be a very serious lodge in terms of we're going to make sure our ritual is bang on. We're going to take it very seriously in our Freemasonry, but also there's going to be a very lighthearted element to it. It's going to be all about the fun. The gavels may be slightly different to normal gavels, and what we wear might be slightly different, hugely different to what you might expect Freemasons to be wearing. You know, there's little things like the tracing boards might be mounted in, you know, one of those road sign things that you see in it, like say road closed or whatever. Might just say lodge closed or what have you. But so there's lots and lots and lots of little tweaks and nuances that will make any visitor kept alert. We are meeting, we didn't want to make it such a mainstream lodge like yours are, and we wanted to keep the fun. We decided to meet just three times a year. And if we need to, we'll bolt on some emergency meetings. So we'll have one meeting a year for sure at Cardinal House, which may well be the installation. But the other meetings, we will get dispensations to hold in strange places. Some ideas we've got are places such as there's an Aston Martin Museum just outside Oxford. I'm sure not a lot of people know that. It's run by the Aston Martin Owners Club, and it's got some fabulous cars there. You know, we could get out to Williams F1. We could go to the new, there's a whole new race circuit being built out towards the other side of Woodstock. We'll see if we can hold a meeting at Silverstone. You know, so everything that's anything that's just completely motoring oriented and slightly unusual, we'll try and get involved in. And of course, we will meet, go and visit other car lodges around the country, of which there are more and more. So, yeah, I think the honest answer is come and see.
You mentioned that did you say it was Essex or Sussex Car Lodge got the number just before Sir William
after
Morris?
Just after. The chequered flag.
So
yeah.
Is this the sort of movement that's happening across the country? There are lots of...
It is, Matthew. It's because I think, you know, lodges themselves, you know, that there's a... A lot of people are interested in motoring lodges, in cars, and it works hand in hand with Freemason, really, because as you get a bit older, you might have a bit more spare time on your hands, and you are more interested in classic. And I must say that we're not just a classic car lodge; we're known as a classic and performance motoring lodge. So anyone with trucks, motorcycles, buses even, you know, or the latest Porsche Turbo down to, you know, an old Darrock or something like that is more than welcome. Or even if they don't have one, they just like cars, they are more than welcome too. I guess it was kicked off in the tercentenary when something called the Square Wheels Club was set up, which is a motoring club for Masons. It's now widened its doors a bit and is open to anyone any non-Masons as well. And then the Square Wheels Lodge was set up. It's not by no means was that the first. I'm not sure of the numbers of lodges now, but I think it's about 30. Motoring oriented lodges, and I'm including motorcycle lodges in that as well. And recently there's been an organization called the National Masonic Vehicle Association, which I've just been appointed comms director of, actually. But and that is to try and bring all the motoring lodges together and to help promote them and to publicize the events to all the other lodges and motoring lodges throughout the country. So it's a one-stop shop. And that's just gaining traction now. It's gone, you know, got approval from Grand Lodge and has now been formed, but it's just taking on members now. So, yeah. Motoring lodge is a good thing. It's not everybody approves of new lodges, though, I have to say.
Okay, did you want to leave that one there?
No. Okay. I was wondering if you'd ask me a question about that.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, okay, so Freemasonry, as you know, people are always talking about the decline of Freemasonry. And I don't think it really is a decline. It's just a bringing back to natural levels. There was a huge boom in Freemasonry. So a bubble, if you like, after the wars. And, you know, it grew in popularity and waiting lists for lodges became longer and longer and longer. So... the younger members formed lodges. And I know my father was a founder member of a lodge because I think it would have been 42 years before he'd got to the chair. So they formed a new lodge and it was, you know, he was the worshipful master after a few years. But things have changed. And lodges were all formed for a reason. And if you look at the number of lodges, if you look at the membership of lodges 30, 40 years ago, you know, even in Henley, the Temple Island Lodge was, I think, had a membership of 85. And, you know, as is the way of most lodges, it's declined and declined and declined. And you get to the point where actually you think, is a lodge viable? And people say, whoa, you don't want to close a lodge because of its history. Well, you know, if it's not viable, if it's not running, if it's not, if its heart's gone, the reason for its living, the reason for its being is no longer there. Well, you know, it has to close, really. It just goes the way it just closes. So if you've got a lodge that has a commonality where people are all singing out of off the same hymn sheet, and they're all interested and all motivated for a particular reason, then why not start a new lodge? Temple Island Lodge in Henley started because it was a shopkeeper's lodge, and that's why it meets on a Wednesday afternoon, because in Henley on Wednesday afternoons the shop shut early. Upper Thames Lodge was a motorboating lodge. Danesfield Lodge was an RAF lodge. I believe Carfax Lodge, your own lodge, Andy, was formed from the engineers that worked at the Morris Garrett, you know, the Morris factory in Cowley. So every lodge has a reason. And if all those engineers go in your lodge, and I know you still have some more, some engineers there, and they haven't brought, and the lodge hasn't got its impetus, it hasn't grown and carried and taken that on, then, you know, I think it just has to close. That's why I wholly promote new lodges forming. There's a lot of banter that goes on. Bloxham Lodge, my old school lodge, that, if you like, is a special interest lodge. And the banter that goes on there is enormous, because, of course, we joke about the school, and we all have a common bond outside of Freemasonry. So I can go to an old schoolboy who I know is not a Freemason, and I can talk to him, and we can have a good laugh. And then I can drop the lodge in, and so I can introduce them to Freemasonry that way. Same with the car lodge. You know, you can introduce people to Freemasonry via a common interest. It's a much, I hate to use the word sell, but it's a much easier sell to somebody joining Freemasonry if there is another interest outside of Freemasonry.
Yeah.
Did I answer that question?
I think so.
in a very diplomatic way as well, Chris.
So moving back to you mentioned briefly about Temple Island Lodge. So
oh, yeah.
you were obviously master of that lodge. Was it for a couple of years?
Yeah. I was. It was a birthday present to myself, actually, joining that lodge. I'd been through the chair twice at I'd been to the chair twice at the old Blocksmith's Lodge. Once in 2002, then in 2007. And then later in about, I suppose 2015, I think I went back in again for the third time and subsequently did another year too. So I've done 4 years in the chair at the old Blocksmiths. But during my first year, that was it. Yeah. So when I was in the chair at the old Blocksmiths for the third time, I hit that ripe old age of 50. I'd visited Temple Island Lodge in Henley many, many years ago, and I'd noted that its consecration date was quite a special date. And so on their 50th anniversary, they had a special meeting where they actually met on the day of consecration, i.e. the 6th of October, 2015, having been consecrated on the 6th of October, 1965. And my 50th birthday present to myself was joining Temple Island Lodge, because I was actually born on the 6th of October, 1965. So the lodge and I are to the day the same age, which is quite extraordinary, because I think that year, give or take 10, there was something like 85 lodges formed throughout the world. And we're talking in Hong Kong, you know, India, wherever, under the United Grand Lodge of England. So there's about 85, of which now 57 exist. I haven't worked out how many are in this country. So the odds of a lodge being formed on the year you were born is probably, in this country, let's say 50 to one. So one a week. But as you know, most of them are formed in a certain, you know, end of the year. So to get a lodge that is formed on your birthday, on the day of your birth, in your hometown, is extraordinary. Yeah. So, you know, it's 2.5 miles from where I live. And so I had to join it. But I did join it, and I didn't actually do a lot of research, because that for me was enough. You know, the fact that we share the same birthdays, that was enough reason for me to join. So I hadn't done any research into the lodge. And I hadn't realized that it had taken a bit of a battering, and wasn't as strong as it had been in the past. And there had been several discussions about handing in its warrant, which would have been a big shame. So as soon as I found that out, I vowed that not under my watch would it ever close. So I was very soon made senior warden, and I set about trying to turn the lodges, trying to turn it around, really. And so we got our first candidate whilst I was senior warden, who'd been who's a good friend of mine, who I'd been kind of queuing up for Freemasonry for about 10 years. And the worshipful master at the time was really, really kind and allowed me to initiate him. And so he stepped aside and allowed me to initiate him. And the worshipful master at the time, just to give you an idea of the state of Temple Island, I say that, or not the state, but this, where it was at, the worshipful master was his second time around in the chair. And he was the lodge's last candidate for initiation.
Wow.
9 years previous. So they hadn't had an initiate for 9 years, and I brought the first one in. So I was quite pleased about that. And then I got into the chair, and once we got one in, it started to, it's one of those things like buses. You wait for 9 years and then a whole load come along. And I think our next, then we did a single next, and then, then we did a double, and then another single, and then a triple, and then a double, and a whatever. I think in the year and a half that I was in the chair, 2 years rather, in 18 months, we'd done something like 21 new members to the lodge.
That's really, really good, isn't it? I mean, I suppose the question is, what's your trick?
Well, have you ever been to the pub, you know, had the king's shilling? Well, you know, I'm always in the pub. No, it's nothing to do with that. It's although we did a whole lot of our interviews in the pub. It's I guess once you got the ball rolling, there's a real joie de vivre and a real, you know, it's an amazing buzz that goes on at Temple Island. And you know, we had a lot of joining members. I think in one meeting we had four joiners. Because they've been to a few of our meetings and they just really enjoyed it. And we started to do things a bit differently. We were trying to abbreviate a bit on the meetings, you know, so it upset some people, but you know, others, they enjoy it. Things like, you know, the risings, for example, you know, I rise for the first, second and third times rather than I rise for the first, yada, yada, I rise for the second, yada, yada. So, you know, you're zipping through stuff that perhaps is a bit labored. when it comes to the festive boards, we started doing themed festive boards. So we did started off with an Indian, and we had a kind of a guest speaker. It was on that particular meeting. We had a lodge member who had rarely come, but came back because I'd found out who he was really. And he's actually doing a podcast for us very soon, which you can ask me about in a minute. We had a Skeletrix car that was modeled on his car that was signed by him, which we auctioned, and that got us going. So after that, we did a German evening with Bavarian food and wine and, Bavarian beer. We've done a Spanish, a Portuguese, a Swedish. We've been all over the world with different cuisine, and we do it, we decorate it all with all the national flags of the country we're going to. And, Brazilian, we had a great Brazilian night because we had a candidate from Brazil who we met in, so we, after the a pub meeting, after a meeting, we went into the pub and this chap saw me, I think it was, yes, holding a Masonic bag with square and compasses. And he came up and said, you are Freemasons. And, my father is a Freemason in Brazil. And of course that rang all the bells and soon he was interviewed. And what was really lovely about that meeting was that it was a Brazilian theme night. And because of course he was Brazilian, and his father flew over especially for the meeting and presented him with his badge. So he did it in a particularly Brazilian way. We expected him to do it in Portuguese, but he actually did it in English. And I think you'll find that the majority of people that went to that meeting will say that it was the most moving and just mind-blowing meeting you've ever been to. It was just passionate and different, and it was just. I think it was about 70 of us there as well. So the Temple Island meetings had gone from six meetings a year, where perhaps three or four they held, and the other two they opened and closed and went to a restaurant. Whereas now we've got meetings, ceremonies coming out of our ears for ages to come. And we at the festive boards we were hitting 50, 60, 70 each time. The lodge room was full up. We were full to capacity. And I said, it's an exciting thing being part of a lodge that has just gone exploded like that. And but what's really good about it, I think, is that it's lifted quite a lot of other lodges up as well. They've realized that, hey, if it can be done, then let's up our game. And I've noticed bits and pieces of Temple Island stuff happening all over the province. And I'm really, really pleased about that because, I absolutely love Freemasonry. And if we can inspire other lodges to grow and to get more enjoyment, then our job is done. So I'm really pleased about the way that's all gone.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, Chris, about a podcast that you've got coming up. Do you want to give a bit more details on that as a shameless plug?
Yes, I like shameless plugs. Yes, on the 1st of September, we have, so this is part of the Sir William Morris Lodge. So I've been promoting the lodge quite heavily. You may have seen our famous Freemasons things that have been going out. Once a week, I do a thing on famous Freemasons that are involved in the motor industry. So far, we've had Henry Ford, Andre Citroen, Malcolm Campbell, the world speed record holder. Who was last week? Oh, Willis, John Willis, who had, of the Willis Jeep fame. And on top of that, we've got this week is a chap called Siegfried Bettmann, who you've never heard of, I'm sure, but he started Triumph. So Triumph Motorcycles and Triumph Cars, that was all him. Walter Chrysler, Stutz, Olds from Oldsmobile, Buick, all these amazing huge names were Freemasons. And I haven't worked it out yet, but I reckon at one point at least 80% of the world's manufacturers of cars were Freemasons. It has to be something like that, at least 80%. Even Rolls-Royce, Charles Rolls, whilst not a Freemason himself, because he died incredibly young, in fact, in 1910, when he was, 20 or 30, in the late, just about 30, I think. He died in a plane crash. But his father was the provincial Grand Master of Monmouthshire, and his grandfather was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, even looking at Rolls-Royce, you've got a, it's got Freemasonry in the veins there. So, so looking closer to home, there's a member which I mentioned earlier who is a chap called David Brodie, who was infamous. No, not infamous. The wrong word. Who was a bit of a folk hero, really, in the saloon car championship racing of the 1970s. And in fact, he raced for four decades. And he's done things like Le Mans, and he raced for Mitsubishi, and but he was known. He came to fame, really. I suppose you can call it fame. In the early 70s, racing an escort called with the slogan "Run, baby, run," and he won 200 races in this car. He was just a loony, and. I've found videos of him driving, and he's just flat out. If he's not, you're not flat out, you're not going fast enough. And so David Brodie, he's been involved in some extraordinary things. Pippa Middleton's father-in-law was involved in a huge accident in which Brodie was involved too. I think they'd been, I think Matthews was his name. Pole position, second position pole. They've been sort of swapping positions throughout the race. And there's a chap in a Mini who kind of got involved and lost it and spun off. And then when he came back onto the track, had lost his orientation and went the wrong way. So these cars were hammering at him at 120 miles an hour. And it was an absolute head on. And I think Matthews got squashed in the middle and Brodie broke his legs and was in hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks. Unfortunately, the chap in the Mini, he didn't make it. But so there's all these stories that went on, and we've got David Brodie on as a live interview. So it'll be a bit like a podcast, but it'll be video as well. And we'll have questions afterwards. And it'll be sort of done. He'll be in the studio, and so he'll do his presentation, and he'll have questions afterwards. So if you've any interest in cars and racing, especially in the saloon car racing championships, then make sure that the 1st of September is in your diary. It's free, but we'd like a donation. And the stories he has to tell are extraordinary. I don't know if you ever saw the documentary on Frank Williams that was put out by the BBC. It's peppered with anecdotes of Brodie, because David Brodie was Frank Williams's best man, and sent Frank Williams £8 to go and pay for the license at the registry office to get married. So David Brodie was, of course, also one of the founding members of Williams Grand Prix. Any interest in racing, this guy has seen it, been it, done it.
Sounds really interesting, to be honest. It sounds really interesting. It sounds like there's going to be a lot of information coming through on that video. So if you've all heard it here first, if you want to come along, 1st of September it is. Get in contact.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I think that's been a pretty comprehensive overview of Sir Morris. Lodge and your journey into Freemasonry. I'm not sure, Andy, if you had any other questions you wanted to put to Chris.
There were many questions, but Chris answered them all.
Not quite all.
No?
No.
What does he?
I'm going to say something that I think you guys have done really, really well with the light blues. You really re-energized it, and you know, I'm really impressed with what you've done. And as you know, I set up the Oxfordshire Travellers, and we're really looking forward to working with you guys in the future to assist lodges that perhaps need a little bit of help after COVID, especially doing ceremonies or non-ceremonies. So in essence, the Travellers are for the more experienced Freemason. It's where we get together and go and support lodges. Traditionally, it's been those lodges who have had a ceremony, because I believe in the ceremony of initiation, passing and raising is so important. And to give the candidate the best experience is paramount. And, you know, some lodges, as we've already discussed, are light on numbers. And I believe that to get as many people in, many bums on seats to give that candidate, just to, you know, to really welcome that candidate in is so important. So that's why I formed the Oxfordshire Travellers, to get people out and to welcome candidates. But of course, as COVID has happened, we realised that we can use our skills elsewhere. And so if there are any lodges out there that want to meet and want to do a ceremony, or you know, haven't got enough officers to carry it out, then they should either get in touch with you guys, the Light Blues, or in fact the Oxfordshire Travellers, and together we can come and supply bodies. And it's not just ceremonies. We're putting together a menu of rituals, such as the first tracing board, explanation of I can't think what
mode of preparation, wasn't it? Was
one that's the one? Thank you. I knew you'd come to my rescue, Matthew. Yeah, preparation of initiate, and yeah, there's a whole plethora of really interesting stuff that's so rarely done, and it is such a lovely thing to see when done properly, and hopefully we can do those things properly. So if any lodge is short of things to do, please get in touch with either the Light Blues or the Oxfordshire Travellers.
Getting two plugs in the podcast, yeah. Chris.
Keep going. No, I've got plenty more.
No, I completely agree. I think it's a really great opportunity for the Light Blues and the Travellers to collaborate on supporting lodges, particularly those lodges that are going to be affected and be struggling in the post or COVID world and the current sort of living with COVID world that we're in at the moment. I guess the last thing to say, Chris, is just thanks so much for your time and taking the time out to chat to us. I think it's just been such a great insight into both your personal journey in Freemasonry, but also the things that you're doing over the next couple of years to do a kind of a lot for Oxfordshire. I think, I mean, setting up a new lodge can't be an easy task, and it certainly sounds like a lodge that's going to be very unique in its meetings and sort of activities that you'll be up to.
And also your advice on how to gain more membership as well was really, really good. I'm sure a lot of people will take advantage of all your ideas as well, like some of them already are. But thanks again. Thanks for coming along and speaking to us today.
Well, I look forward to seeing you all again at a lodge meeting sometime in the near future, as soon as we can get back, and hopefully we can get back to really enjoying our Freemasonry. So thank you very much for the opportunity of talking to you all, and I'll see you again soon.